And I'll talk a little bit about the second meditation. What I wanted to do for this series while I'm here is kind of key the meditations to the Tuesday night Buddhism in a Nutshell class. And I don't know how many people are planning to go to both things, and we haven't had our first class yet. But I thought to kind of set us up with a meditation on impermanence tonight, because that's kind of one of the key things that we're going to be talking about in terms of what the Buddha says is, you know, can be a cause of suffering for us, is just unawareness of the impermanent nature of things. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and then have the second meditation that I'll guide you through, and then just have a little bit of discussion. I'll give maybe, as we go along, what I could do too, because we have enough time, is give a little bit of instruction about the obstacles to meditation and the antidotes to those obstacles, which is always great to review, even when you have the instruction. And I know it's going to be like different groups of people on the Monday night, so we can kind of just do a little bit. But I thought to do both a focusing meditation and an analytical meditation, short sessions every Monday night, so we get practice with the two kind of styles of meditation. So we'll begin with breath awareness and what we can do. Some of you may, you know, be quite experienced in breath awareness meditation. One of the things that can be helpful to do, we can either focus on the sensations of the breath in the full body. That's one way of doing it. So have kind of a wider focus of the entire body wherever we feel the sensations in the body. Some people find it helpful to narrow the focus to one area of the body. The abdomen can be good. Just feeling the diaphragm as it's expanding and contracting. And one of the advantages of focusing on the diaphragm and the abdomen, especially if you have a lot of distracting thoughts, it just kind of brings the focus out of your head and can be grounding, you know, just kind of literally, and really bring the energy out of your head and really subdue the distracting thoughts. So a lot of people, because I think one of the obstacles that we often have in the beginning as we're starting to meditate is just having a lot of distracting thoughts. So bring the energy down. Another area that can be helpful to focus on is the chest, the lungs expanding and contracting, so feeling the sensations there. And the softest part of the body to focus on is just the area around the nostrils. And sometimes you can feel the air in the upper lip. Sometimes you can just feel a little bit of coolness right here in your nostrils, so wherever you feel that. That's the subtlest object, and sometimes people find that helpful because they have to focus so much on, you know, even feeling a sensation there, that they find it easier to stay focused just because it is so subtle. So what we can do is just spend a few minutes at the beginning. I'll kind of guide you through the different places in the body, and then you might want to settle on just one, or maybe you've already kind of figured out what works best for you, but we'll just go ahead and kind of cruise through a little bit and see which area seems to work out the best. So first, getting in our meditation posture. And so the most important part of the posture is to have your back straight, whether you're sitting down or whether you're sitting up in a chair. So as if there were kind of a cord pulling up from the crown of your head, and your shoulders even, and your head tilted just slightly forward, your chin just tucked down a bit. And we often try to practice with our eyes just slightly open, and this helps with an advanced obstacle called subtle thinking that we'll talk about as we kind of progress through. But if you have your eyes just slightly open with a little bit of light coming in, that can be helpful. And your hands can either be in the traditional meditation posture with your right hand on top of your left and your thumbs touching, forming a little triangle just right below your navel. Or you can just be resting your hands on your thighs. That's also fine. If you're sitting down, your legs are crossed comfortably. Sometimes it's helpful if you're sitting down on the cushion on the floor to have couple of extra cushions under your knees. That keeps your knees from getting sore. Or if you're sitting up in a chair, have your legs braced in a nice, stable posture. And then we'll begin, since it's the end of the day, you may have had a long day, have a little tension or stress built up in the body. We'll begin with a body sweep before we turn our attention to the breath, just bringing our attention down through the body and deliberately relaxing any areas of tightness or tension that might have crept in today. So starting at the crown of the head, sweeping down. Pay attention to the forehead and the area around your eyes where we often hold a lot of tension. And sweeping down the face. The jaw, as much as possible, we have our mouth closed, breathing through our nose unless we have a cold or some obstruction. But even though our mouth should be closed, our jaw shouldn't be tight or clenched. And then pay attention to your neck and your shoulders. An area we often hold tension. Sometimes it's helpful to imagine a warm viscous liquid, something like warm honey just melting through, melting any knots. So lifting the chest, opening up the chest, getting that nice upright posture, but the body relaxed around that nice upright spine. So our posture is alert, yet relaxed. These two qualities are not contradictory, they're complementary. So relaxation plus alertness. Relaxing down through the torso, relax the belly. Relax the buttocks. And sweeping down the legs, all the way down to the feet. And then we'll settle. After this initial settling of the body, we'll begin by just taking three deep breaths, big inhalation, big exhalation to get rid of any stale air might be in the body. And then settle with the breath focusing. And we'll first begin by focusing on the full body sensation of breathing. So wherever you feel the breath in the body, not manipulating your breath in any way, not changing it in any way, not making your breath longer or shorter or deeper. Just the natural rhythm of breathing. And first the wide focus, just attending to the sensations wherever you feel those sensations in your body. Just trying to stay with the sensations of the breath in the body. Of course, your mind will wander off. And when it does, just gently release the distraction, whatever it may be, and return to the sensations of the breath. Your only job right now is just being here in the present moment with your body breathing. try focusing the attention on the area of the abdomen. So taking that wide focus and narrowing down to just the sensations in the abdomen as you're breathing. Again, thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, distractions from noises outside might pull your attention away. The minute you notice you've been distracted, just release and return to the breath, gently releasing whatever distracting thoughts, returning to the sensation. Move the attention up in the body to the chest. The lungs are expanding and contracting, so trying to localize the focus there in that area of the body. See if it's easier to stay focused there, if the sensations are easier to follow as the lungs expand and contract. Letting go of the distractions from the noises outside, whatever thoughts might be pulling you away, and just try to stay with those sensations of the breath. Up to the area of your nostrils, either the air on your upper lip or just feeling the air going in and out of your nostrils. Very subtle area to focus. See how that works, to try to keep the attention there, the sensations in your nostrils. another few moments. Choose whichever area of the body or the full body breathing seem to work out best for you in terms of being able to stay focused. Maybe there was one of those options that seemed to work out best. You were able to hold your attention there more easily because of the sensations. Just a few more minutes on your own, just picking whichever area seemed to work best, staying with those sensations, just allowing the body to breathe naturally. Releasing any distracting thoughts, any distractions because of sense experiences. Just over and over, just releasing, returning to the breath. Not trying to push away any thoughts or sounds, not struggling with your mind. Just gently releasing and returning to the breath. does the body seem to work best? Does anybody have a favorite? Nostrils? Abdomen?
Yeah.
Very bottom of the abdomen.
Okay, so all the way down. Yeah. Okay. What about you, Tammy?
Probably the, I think the chest, the nostrils tightened everything too much for me, like at this time of the day, I think.
Yeah.
I actually used a space that's more up into my sinus.
Yeah.
Like I usually kind of like start here and feel grounded and then come up. And then when I use that space, that's almost kind of below my eyes, or it almost feels like it's behind my eyes, but more of the sensation of air movement in my sinus, a much greater sense of spaciousness. So I usually move up into that, and when I can settle into that and push it out a little bit, then it's and it's easier then from that sense of spaciousness. It depends on what object, you know, but from that space, it's easier to kind of do that. Awareness of mind itself to kind of drop into this mahamudra. So
we're not quite a mahamudra yet. We're just doing awareness of moving.
So I'll tend to use that one for spaciousness.
Yeah.
And then, but yeah, for grounding, it's usually kind of like coming down here, or kind of like that face breathing, you know.
Right.
Pause.
Yeah.
You know, kind of bring it down. So it kind of depends on what's up.
Right. And Pamela, why did the nostril work better for you? Just because it was quite subtle and you needed to focus more? Or it was just
no, I just, it's so, I love the way it's like I can feel it going in, and I can feel the coolness really exaggerated on the in and the warmth really exaggerated on the out. And it just, I feel so connected to the air when it's right there. I hadn't thought about bringing it up a little higher. I might try that. It depends sometimes, right? There are other times where down lower my abdomen might feel better, but that's like my go-to. It just
to the nostrils.
Yeah.
And when they get it like here, you can kind of bring things in, and then when I bring the awareness up, that's when I can relax into opening.
I can see the expansiveness of that.
So for different people, it's, you know, different things, and I find for myself, sometimes the grounding of the abdomen really helps my crazy, distracted mind, like bringing energy down in the body like that, or like you said, you know, just really like the therapy.
It's interesting to hear you talk about that, because in my early days of meditation, the nostrils was more like the gate of everything, and it would come in and out. But when you said that, then I noticed that I practiced Kundalini Yoga, and the whole root block, the chakra, the base of the energy level, that the sensation of my breath there was like the font.
Nice.
It was nice. I didn't realize how nice it was until you shared.
So when we're working on this style of meditation, which sometimes we call it fixation meditation or single-pointed concentration meditation, so in the Tibetan tradition, as many of you I'm sure know, you know, we have two different main styles of meditation. One where we're focusing on an object, trying to develop our concentration on an object. It could be the breath, it could be a visualized image. That's also something that we often work with. And so we say we're developing kind of two main qualities, mindfulness and vigilance, like two qualities of mind. And so mindfulness refers to just the mind staying on the object, like just staying with the object without clamping down, like the, you know, often the metaphor is given like tuning the string of a guitar. It's not too loose and not too tight. So kind of counterintuitively, when we clamp down too much, that agitates our minds and makes ourselves more distracted. And I think I have this pet peeve about like so-called mindfulness instruction in some books. It's like a paragraph or two. You know, just watch your breath. Like, that's all. Because often people, when their mind wanders, clamp down more, which agitates their mind and makes them more you know, more distracted. So it's a counterintuitive correction to a really crazy distracted mind to just loosen the tightness of the focus, because that enables us to get deeper into the relaxation. But it's not something you think. You think, oh, I'm not trying hard enough. You know, and then people just get frustrated and stop. You know, I just think it's really important to get that instruction right about that antidote to that obstacle. So the mindfulness, just staying with the object. And then sometimes the word is translated as vigilance, and that refers to knowing when we're off. Like the part of the mind, sometimes it's called like the watchdog, that knows that our mind has strayed. So it's another part of our mind. And that's something that's important to train as we're learning to meditate too, because, and you may have had this experience in the beginning, and I know, you know, a lot of you, it seems like you've been meditating for a while, but in the beginning, you'll sit down to watch your breath, and then 20 minutes into your fantasy about your vacation in Hawaii, you know, what am I doing sitting cross-legged on the floor with a candle lit? Oh, right. So that means our vigilance isn't even there. Like, it's so easy to waste a lot of time. So the vigilance piece, you know, you notice as you train that it kicks in quicker and quicker, and then you just don't waste time. And one of the techniques, too, with breath awareness meditation that can help with training vigilance, and some of you may have tried this, is labeling the distraction. But just labeling very simply and briefly and going back to the breath. And sometimes the label can just be like sensation, thought, sound. You don't label, you know, memory that my husband didn't wash the dishes tonight because he's such a slacker and he never does housework. Like, spin out a whole narrative, because then that's a whole other distraction. So it's really important, if you're labeling the distraction, to just make it super simple, just, oh, thought, let it go. Right? And also not beating ourselves up, because that's another thing we can do when we start to meditate is, oh, everybody else can just sit there for 20 minutes watching the breath with no distraction. I'm sure I'm the only one that was just going off constantly. And some of you also may have tried the technique of counting each cycle of breathing, you know, from 1 to 10, and often in the beginning we don't get past 2. Like, and then they say, if you lose track, start over again at 1. It's not at all uncommon not to make it past 2. But that can be an extra anchor to the mind when you're beginning with breath awareness also. But it's also important that it's awareness of breathing and not awareness of counting. So like the counting, just like the labeling, is just touch on the counting lightly as an extra kind of prop for the breath awareness, that it's still the awareness of breathing, and you're not just like, 1, okay, next one's going to be 2, okay.
Was that on the in-breath or the out-breath?
Yeah. Right, exactly. And then you spin out, like, because our mind loves distraction. It's like our mind's job description is to think. So it really wants to, and it will just, you know, spin off on whatever storyline that we give it. So it's really, it is kind of going against the grain to just stay, you know, with the breath. There's so many advantages, and as we kind of go through the Monday nights for a while I'm here, you know, it's helpful. Actually, we say the first obstacle to meditation is laziness, which is described as just not sitting down on the cushion to meditate in the first place. And the antidote to that obstacle is understanding the benefits of meditation. So we'll talk more and more about what is the benefit of sitting there doing this stupid thing of watching the breath. Like, why on earth would we do that? And there's all kinds of great benefits to that. So we'll talk about that more.
But I particularly appreciated your use of the word release the distraction.
Mm.
Yeah. It made it so ephemeral.
Mm.
And about labeling, when I first discovered that if you do simple labeling, you can't do the thing you were doing. You know, it's like,
yeah.
Because like one of the things I do is I create conversations in my mind. I mean, there are people I don't ever have to talk to because created the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So the label creating conversation. Like, you know, or just, you can't do what you
were
doing. Because
it derails it.
You can't,
just by labeling.
It's like it forces the, well, not even forces, but it creates the space for the release. And I never really, I never heard someone use that word. I
yeah.
That very, air. There was just a lot of air in that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because what we do so much is struggle and think we've got it wrong. And it, like the gentle, just release and return to the breath, release and return, because I think often, too, we just are like, oh, I've got to push it away, and struggle, no thought, you know, and then we just get wound up. It's like it's supposed to make us feel better, and it just makes us neurotic, which is like totally not the point. It's funny, one of the teachers, Sophie Rinpoche, I remember hearing, when he was teaching the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and I was listening to a tape, like, long ago, about 15 years ago, of him teaching, and he goes, have about 25% of your attention on your breath. Like, don't feel like it needs to be 100%. Just, like, 25%, just so it's stable, and that's what's happening. And then he kind of made a joke, and he said, if you're German, 10%. If you're from California, 60%. Like, it was kind of funny that too loose, you know, a little bit more attention, but not to feel like, and one of the other analogies is sort of like, you've got stability on the object, like the breath, just like the ice is formed, you can still see water going underneath, but the ice is solid, you know, so I love that analogy, because it's kind of what it's like, okay, I'm not losing the breath, but it doesn't mean that there aren't just little fluttering thoughts going through or some awareness of the sound or something. But I don't have to struggle and push it away. It's just not, I'm still on the ice. Like, I'm still focused on the breath. So I think all of these things, because we think it needs to be perfect and it's like some sensory deprivation tank that I'm in somehow with just the breath, and it's just unrealistic. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're going to be aware, but it's just, can we not be completely pulled away, can we stay with whatever our chosen object is? So that can be really helpful. Yeah.
I like the image that I remember you said years ago, where like it's like you're sitting at an outdoor cafe, and you're sitting with your friend, and your friend's the breath, and someone comes by that looks kind of interesting, and that's sort of the thought, you just don't get up from the table and follow that person down the street.
Ignoring what your friend said for a moment.
You lose it for a moment, but you're still at the table.
Yeah.
Walk down the street.
Yeah. And I always give you credit for it, too.
Okay. All right. Don't be.
And I'm not plagiarizing.
That's right.
Copyrighted. And if you like that, you should go to Neville and her
sessions. I'm sure I stole that from someone else. There are no new.
It was once written.
Yes.
If you're sitting at the campfire, you know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Not Starbucks or in the coffee place. Tupelo's or whatever. I discovered that the other day. Okay. So I thought we'd do another little practice since we've got time. And if you need to get up and stretch, I'll be introducing it verbally for a minute. So if you need to kind of change your position and stretch before we sit again. So I thought this kind of relates to the Buddhism in a nutshell topic a little bit. When we talk about the first noble truth, the truth of dissatisfaction, as the translation that I like better than suffering, and when you come tomorrow night, you'll hear all about why. I'm a little bit picky sometimes about semantics and translations, and I have my pet peeves, many of them, and one is that word, suffering. So dissatisfaction is a bit better translation of the actual Sanskrit, and we'll kind of unpack that tomorrow night. And there's various things that kind of characterize our lives that are a source of dissatisfaction, struggle, suffering for us. And one is the reality of impermanence. And what I mean by impermanence is just the momentary changing nature of reality, right? And mostly what causes suffering and fractured for us is we don't realize that that's the way things are. We expect things to stay the same. We expect the good things to last. And when they don't, we freak out. We think that the bad things are going to last, so we've already freaked out because we think whatever horrible is happening is going to last forever. And basically, we just really don't have the deep realization of just the ever-changing nature of things. We can see gross change, but gross change is just a culmination of moment by moment by moment change. For example, if there were... fresh flowers. There are fresh flowers here on the altar. These guys last a long time. These are like the best.
They're
pretty. For ages. But the fact is they don't last forever. And so when we don't analyze, we kind of feel like, okay, there's a bud and it opens and then there's a flower and then the flower just abides for some time until it decays. It feels to us like the progression is like bud, opens, flower, some kind of stable state, and then dead. Okay, maybe wilted.
One second and the next.
And it feels that way. Like one, you know, whenever next Sunday we'll come in here and it'll probably be wilted. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it's just there's some stable state. And it's not true. The only reason that we see the gross change of the wilted flower is because moment by moment by moment, the flower's decaying. It doesn't decay all at once. In a week, it's decaying slowly. We just can't see that subtle change. We can only see the gross change. So for us, it just feels like, oh, the flower died. Like, big surprise. If we somehow perceive subtle impermanence, we'd somehow be able to see that that's happening all the time, right? So why do, you know, why we see the gross change. Have you ever seen, it's so funny, many years ago, I hadn't seen one of my best friends in a number of years. I'd lived somewhere else, and then I was coming back to the Bay Area, and then I was like, oh, let's meet for coffee. And it was a friend I'd known since we were in our early 20s. And this is like 2 decades later, I think, at that point, or, you know, 20, 25 years later. And so we were going to meet in this cafe in San Francisco, and he walked in. And I was just completely shocked because it had been about 7 years since I'd seen him. And I was like, I knew his father from when we were in our early 20s. And I was like, Ron turned into his dad. Like, when did he turn? He looked exactly like his father had looked when I met his father when we were in our early 20s. His father would have been about the age that we were then when we were meeting in San Francisco. Now, if I'd seen him every day for that 7 years, I never would have had that thought or never would have noticed how much he had aged, right? So I saw this gross change just because there had been this period of not seeing the subtle daily change, right? So it fools us. It fools us. We kind of expect, you see an old friend and you sort of don't think, you know, that they will have been 7 years older with all the more gray hair and the extra pounds and all of the was going on, right? So we get pulled. So Buddhism says if we and this is one of the realizations that we develop in our meditation practice. It's a very profound realization. And Buddhism says if we had a deep realization of impermanence, we'd suffer so much less. Right? This is a big cause of suffering for us, is our unawareness, our lack of realization of impermanence. So it's one of the it's sort of really a breakthrough realization when you get an awareness of subtle impermanence. Maybe at some point during the class we'll talk about the stages of the path to enlightenment, the 5 paths and kind of what happens when on the path, which is very cool to really understand when do you get which realization. And this is a pretty major realization which changes everything for us. So I thought to lead us through, since it sort of relates to the first noble truth, which is going to be what we're going to start talking about tomorrow night, just lead you through a way that we can get some insight. Because even before you get a stable, perfect realization of it, just any reminder that we can have of like, this is just natural that things change. It's not like I made a mistake or something's horribly wrong, but this is just the nature of reality, can really, really help. So I thought I'd just take us through, and then we'll just kind of see what came up for people. We'll be sitting maybe about 15 or 20 minutes for this one as well, so getting in a nice, stable posture with your back straight. I'll let you settle in to your comfortable meditation posture. And then settle the mind with just a few minutes of breath awareness meditation. You can use whatever kind of area of the body seems easiest for you. So just settling the mind by focusing on the breath. So now, still attending to the breath, start to become aware as you observe your breathing of the impermanence of your breathing. Each breath is different from the one that came before it, different from the one that came after it. You're breathing in different air with every breath. And your body is changing with each breath, different sensations in your nose, in your nostrils, in your lungs, in your body. So in each moment, with each breath, there's change and flux and flow. So just take a few moments observing the breath, observing the impermanent nature of the breathing process. body seems like we're sitting still in one position, but so much change going on. Think of the blood flowing through your veins, your heart beating in every moment. Maybe you ate something before you came, your food being digested. Become aware of all of the other changes going on in your body. And then on an even subtler level, think about the cellular level. Nutrients are passing through the cell membranes, the molecular level, the atomic level, the subatomic level. Take a few moments thinking of all of the change that's going on at the subtler levels of your body. So much change and flux and flow, the cellular, molecular, atomic levels. Turn your attention to your mind. Your mind, too, is composed of many parts, thoughts, perceptions, feelings, memories, images, following one after the other seamlessly. So spend a few moments just simply observing the ever-changing flow of experiences in your mind. Without following them, just observing, watching a thought, a memory, feeling arise, abide for some time, pass away, flow of your mental experience. And now, after reflecting on the impermanence of your inner world, your own body and mind, turn your attention to the outer world. So thinking about your immediate surroundings, the cushion or chair that you're sitting on, and the floor, the walls, the windows, the ceiling, the furniture, the altar, your immediate environment, the room that we're in, even though we call these inanimate objects, they're all made of molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, all going through momentary change, movement. Become aware of this in the inanimate objects in this room, how much change is going on at that subtle level. And then turn your attention to the other people in this room. Just like you, their bodies and minds are continually in a state of flux. Same kind of analysis that you just did for your own inner world. It's also true for them. Take a moment to reflect on the ever-changing nature of the other people in the room. just take a few more moments to let your attention go out from this room, thinking of all objects, all beings in our world, and in the whole universe, all exactly the same, changing moment by moment. Nothing stays the same for even a moment. All that change, try and get a feel, a vast feel for the ever-changing nature of all of the things in the universe, all sentient beings, all inanimate objects, all the same, being in the nature of moment by moment change. And conclude the meditation by thinking it's unrealistic to cling to things, to expect them to be unchanging, to expect them to be permanent. Not only are the things that are beautiful and pleasing to us in the nature of change, they won't last forever. So to cling to them just causes us unhappiness, but also that which is unpleasant also will change. So there's no need to struggle and become overwhelmed when we experience things that are unpleasant. And just becoming more attuned to this nature of things. Everything in a state of change and flux will enable us to be much more spacious in our relationship to things, not so upset when they change. And just take a moment to gradually come out of meditation, shift your posture, gently open your eyes. Enjoyed that. She's smiling. Any questions or experiences with that one?
I have a lot of, like, over the past few months, when I start thinking about impermanence in a meditation, I feel like a lot of anxiety come up.
Mm-hmm.
And then it feels like I'm too aware of things changing in life, like in a subtle way, maybe more now in my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like I can't, like I'm present in the moment, but then simultaneously I'm also seeing like a macro level of it maybe, and then it just like feels like paralysis or panic. Like.
And I think, you know, one of the things is, in a way, that means that it's landing.
Okay.
So it's like,
yeah,
a good sign. I mean,
yay!
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. But it really does mean, and I've heard, actually, I've heard Lama Zopa say this, when people have that feeling of like, he goes, awesome.
Oh, good.
Like, that's great. Because if it weren't landing, and the analogy that actually Lama Tsongkhapa gives is like, he goes, there's like a bullseye, and if you're actually hitting the bullseye, that's when that happens. If you're shooting your arrows over here, nothing's going to shift, and you're not even going to have that subjective experience of like groundlessness,
yeah,
right? Which can be quite, yeah, disconcerting, and it means that it's working, like the meditation is working to loosen that strong clinging. Now, sometimes you can, it helps to remind yourself, because sometimes that groundlessness comes when you're just like, oh, I'll cease to exist too. Like, you know,
yeah,
everything is changing.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm just going to go out of existence. And I've heard Lama Zopa talk about it. He goes, your mind stream, it's changing moment by moment, but it'll never go out of existence.
Mm.
Like, there's always going to be, you know, we don't have to worry, just because things are changing, we'll never, like, our very same mind stream, which is changing moment by moment by moment, because of causes and conditions, will eventually become a Buddhism-like mind that'll never cease to exist. Because I think that visceral, panicky feeling we get is almost like, I'm not going to exist anymore,
yeah,
either. You know, and yes, as the form that you're in now, but in a way we're dying every nanosecond, right? Like, you know, there are these big transitions that we call death, but we're not the same from even moment to moment to moment.
Yeah.
But because our mind stream can never be destroyed, we'll never cease to exist. So sometimes to offset the panicky feeling is to go, yeah, and I won't cease to exist. Like, my mind stream will is constantly changing, but it will never cease to exist, like, if the panic becomes kind of overwhelming. But
yeah,
sometimes I found it helpful just to hang with it, because it really does mean, oh, that groundlessness is great, because
okay,
it means that solid clinging is dissolving a little bit. You know, there's a great book by Pema Chodron, and I think it's The Places That Scare You. Now, I can't remember. I think it's that one, and she talks a lot about that groundless feeling in that one, and I found that really helpful at a point where I was struggling with a very similar thing. It's just kind of like, you know, and it really helped to reinforce, like, yeah, it's kind of panicky, and it's you've hit the mark, like,
okay,
you've really hit the bullseye. So it's
okay.
So sometimes it can be reassuring just to know.
Yeah.
You know, Lama Zopa, one teaching that I was attending, and I've never forgotten this because it was so great. He was talking actually about meditation on emptiness, on personal selflessness, which can give a very similar feeling. It's like, you know, that strong sense of self that we cling to is dissolving. And he goes, the fear comes. The way he said it, the fear comes because it has to come.
Mm.
Like, the fear comes because we have been clinging.
Yeah.
And then he goes, it's just like when you're wading through a river with a strong current and you get scared and you want to go back. He goes, just go. Because that's your chance. Like, the way he said it was just like, it's just like wading through a river,
yeah,
and you're in it and it feels scary. He's like, just keep going to the other side. He goes, this is your chance. And I just love that metaphor.
Yeah.
Just like, don't freak out and back off. Just go for it.
That's
and
very
yeah,
helpful.
It is scary.
Yeah.
But you just go. You know?
I had an experience of, for a couple, 3 months of several years ago, where I was, it, emptiness, or like, there's no truth, there's no right, there's no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the middle of all of that, and I think, wow, is this how depressed people feel? Because I was like, oh. And I went to a day long with a Zen priest that I really like, Reb Anderson. I haven't heard. And I was telling him this story, and here's what he told to me, like the go for it part. He said,
Oh, that is so great, because that means you're dying every day. You get the opportunity to meet the new Rebecca every day.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if we weren't impermanent, we could never become.
No.
Every day is this new one.
Like, I'm not having that sense, like, intellectually, like, I, like, you know, my mind hears that bit, like, it's an opportunity.
But does it feel like that?
No, like, experientially, it feels, like, very hopeless and kind of, like, very disengaged from life then, in a way, too, because it's, like...
Because we've always been engaging from that strong clinging.
Yeah.
So it takes getting used to still realize where every bit, I mean, nothing's changed. You've just gotten an insight into how reality always was, but you just let go of the narrative of, you know, that strong permanence to things that was just an illusion all along. But it takes a while to kind of get used to, okay, how do I operate out of that place of spaciousness and non-clinging? Like, what does that feel like? And it just takes some getting used to. And then the energy will come back. It's just you feel like you've lost something, but what you've lost was never there ever in the first place. It was just all you've lost is your wrong concept of how you thought you existed, which was just a cause of all of your suffering, so, like, hooray. But it just does take quite a while to kind of get used to the new paradigm, and then you find that out of that, you know, what looks in on one level like groundlessness is just this incredible, like, spaciousness and opportunity. It'll just take a while for that shift from, like, whoa, to, coming out of that.
Yeah.
So it's sort of just be patient and kind of hang out there and then remind yourself, like, when it starts to feel scary, of, like, I haven't lost anything other than the illusion, the hallucination, as long as Opa says, just this hallucination of how things were, that actually was a cause of tremendous suffering. So it's not like you've lost anything that you had, except just the hallucination of how you existed. You know, so that can be really helpful.
Like the Wizard of Oz, you pull back the great curtain.
Well, you know, it's a funny process because we tend to live in a place that is sort of like kind of an eternalism, which is when someone dies or something changes, our mind is always shocked. You know, like you come into a room and says, "Where's so and so?" And it's like, "Oh, you didn't hear they were in a car accident, died yesterday." And they're like, "How can that be? I just saw them."
Yeah, you know.
And so we exist in this place of sort of this eternalism. And then when you start to eat at the edges of that, and that sort of like that panicky feeling comes in, because we're at this extreme, when that comes up, it sort of becomes this existential crisis because it has the flavor of complete nihilism.
Right?
So it's a complete swing over.
Yeah.
So, but the point is, when we do that sort of that intellectual process of an analytical meditation, when you start to get that feeling, that feeling itself, as scary as it is sort of is the edges of that realization. Right, and so as you were saying, sort of being with it, or else sometimes the way I kind of describe it is when that starts to come up, I'll gently approach it, and then that starts to become my object. So when that feeling comes in, that's not the intellectual process. That's the so when that really comes up, and it's like, whoa, and then I'll kind of gently start to watch that, and it's kind of a panicky thing, but then I realize what that feeling is. Is the eternalistic part realizing that no, you're not that, and there's a part of your mind that wants to, that's the hallucination. The reason why it has a negative, panicky feeling is like no, don't go there, because I'm always here. Don't go there. But what happens is when you can sit with it for a while, and say, well, why is that, and what is it, and you can sort of watch the thought balloons that bubble up around what it is, and it's like, everything's going to die, I'm going to die, I'm not going to be here. And then, but when you start to look at that, and you can start to see more of like the flow, the process of what's going on. And that's then when you kind of realize that, that it's the seed, and then the sprout, and then the plant, and then the flower, and then you start to get more of a sense of the time lapse of it. So the panicky feeling is the edge of that realization. So if you jump right on it, then it'll be like, you know, a super ball in a box. You know, it's like eternalism, nihilism.
And I don't know, but has it been a shock for you? It was a shock for me. It's like I didn't really think that I had signed up to meditate to feel that way.
I think what scares me most.
You know, I'm being infiltrated here. You know, and it is in most of the lineages that I've been exposed to.
I always try to give that, like when I'm teaching a meditation class, like full disclosure the first night. Like if you just came here to be calm and feel better, like that won't necessarily happen when you're in solitary confinement with
your mind.
Get ready for the roller coaster ride. Like it's not just about like a peaceful oasis from everyday ordinary reality. Like looking at this stuff,
we're gonna puncture all this.
Welcome to the monkey house.
I was trying to tell you, they don't believe me until it starts happening. They're like, oh, that's what you're
like Parenthood.
They're so cute.
But when things get weird, that's like, you know, that's a great sign.
Okay.
You know, that's a great sign. And
yeah, it really does. It means that it's
And then the interesting thing about it is when you can just sort of gently sit with it, and then it dissipates, and then it was like, oh, I'm still here. Mm. And then eventually, you can kind of, when you do that enough times, you can kind of start to get a sense of like when the weird stuff is out there. And usually, when we sit, when you get a sense of it, the mind doesn't want to even get close to that. So when it sneaks up on you like that, it's like, what it usually has to do is like jump out and go, whoa. But then you can kind of start to look for those weird moments and then be with them. And it's not like we're seeking experience and holding on to experience, because then you don't want to make kind of be seeking an experience like, this is, I want to go here. But when that comes up, it's just
different kind of clinging.
It's a different kind of thing, but just...
You don't have to like it just because it's, you know, just because we're excited about it doesn't mean you have to like it.
if it was a porcupine, right, you could actually hold a porcupine, right?
Yeah.
But you'd have to, like, kind of hold it very gently. And that stuff could be really, it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So you just be real careful with it, and then just sort of think, well, that's interesting, because it'll, you know... If you can sit with it for a really long time, that's awesome, because you're really getting into realization and you'll get through it, and some of that edgy stuff will dissipate out.
Yeah.
But
kind of makes sense.
And that's where the compassion practice comes in. And loving kindness. You know, and that's why we balance the wisdom side with the compassion side.
Yeah.
Because then it's like, gives you that hopefulness of like, oh, this is why I'm in this thing. And I can do this, and, you know, kind of going on in those qualities, because if our practice isn't balanced with both the wisdom and the compassion, it's just kind of too much to go to those edgy places all the time. And so we kind of warm it up with the compassion and loving kindness practice.
Yeah.
So sometimes I find, too, when I'm just, like, it's good to have that happen. And it's also good to balance it out with, like, the bodhicitta idea, and, like, this is why...
Yeah.
You know, this is the whole reason for doing this is it's all about benefiting beings, and then the hopefulness comes in when you balance out with that wing of the bird too, you know. So when I always find, like, if I'm doing a retreat that's a lot of compassion and loving kindness meditation, I always, like, in the evening session, try and do a little bit of emptiness or impermanence. And then vice versa, if I'm doing a retreat that's all emptiness practice, I always sprinkle in, you know, bodhicitta practices and compassion practices, just to get that balance.
Yeah.
Because it really does invoke a different energy, and for me, those practices get that hopeful energy back, and just like, oh, this is what I'm aiming for with all of this kind of tearing apart the old paradigm of me, so that I can become like this amazing bodhisattva. Like, this is what I'm doing. It isn't just to just tear everything apart and then you're kind of left with nothing. It's like to transform into this being with these qualities. So that can really help.
You sound like the Tibetan version of Mary Poppins. A little bit of sugar helps the medicine go down.
It does.
Well, that's why, you know, opening with, you know, our preliminary prayers, refuge bodhicitta, you know, and settlement prayer, setting our motivation and kind of like the direction, and then whatever the practice is, especially if you're doing like emptiness or whatever, And then closing with that dedication, because that makes that nice sandwich of, you know,
yeah.
of like
yeah.
that opening, the motivation, bodhicitta, setting intention, and then the dedication kind of mm-hmm. places yeah. it in that context too.
Yeah.
So that's, you know.
Yeah. Which we didn't do tonight, because I didn't know if there's going to be brand new people, and I didn't know, you know, people would be put off by a lot of, like, ritual or whatever. So often when I'm just doing kind of dropping things, I don't do a lot of that kind of stuff. I just do, like, the motivation. But it is what David said, is definitely true. It's, like, within that context of remembering yeah. the whole context of why we're doing the main meditation can be really helpful.
In any context, actually, I have a dedication card.
Okay. We can just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of like to just meditate on it. Any other questions or comments before we call it a night? All right. So let's dedicate the positive energy. So just thinking of the positive energy that we generated through our practices tonight, both practices and the discussion that we've had. And the discussion we just had now reminded me of one of my favorite verses of Aryadeva, one of Nagarjuna's disciples, and he said, even just doubting that things exist in the way that they appear tears samsara to shreds.
Mm-hmm.
So even mm-hmm. just generating that doubt, just loosening the strong hold of that clinging and grasping, unbelievable. So much virtue in just even introducing that first element of doubt that things exist in the way they appear. And we've done that tonight with this impermanence meditation. Really examine that subtle impermanence to loosen that strong clinging. So let's dedicate that positive energy that we might be able to attain that realization and all of the other realizations of the past, leading to full enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thank you all for coming out on a rainy Monday night. That was super fun.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.